The brightness is hard to obtain constantly, while the forces of evil are very terrible. What other good could threaten those forces except by that which is called the perfect bodhicitta? This is the benefit discovered by the lords of the sages after meditating for many eons. Thus deep-welling happiness overflows and uplifts immeasurable masses of beings. Those who long to transcend the hundreds of miseries of existence, who long to relieve creatures of their sorrows, who long to enjoy many hundreds of joys, must never abandon the bodhicitta. So these verses continue on directly from the verses we looked at yesterday. And they're the verses in which Shantideva first speaks of the bodhicitta. And the word bodhicitta is one of those key Buddhist terms which don't really have a satisfactory translation. In fact, in one of Sangharakshita's lectures on the bodhicitta, he said the word bodhicitta is actually not a good word for the word bodhicitta, for the bodhicitta, because it's something really that defies any language. Let's try and unpack it a little bit. So bodhi, you probably all know, means enlightenment or awakening. And bodhi is the goal of the Buddhist life. We saw that yesterday. The goal of wisdom and compassion. Citta can be translated as mind or as heart, or consciousness even. So you could translate bodhicitta as the enlightened mind, the enlightened heart, the enlightened consciousness. But in the context of the Bodhicharavatara and texts like it, the term bodhicitta has another kind of flavour. It's not simply the enlightened mind. The bodhicitta has the flavour of something that arises within someone before they're fully enlightened, that impels them in the direction of gaining enlightenment for all beings. So in Shantideva's text, the bodhicitta has something of the quality of the first definitive, decisive shift from self-centeredness to selflessness, from being predominantly occupied with one's own concerns to being active in bringing about the bringing benefit to all beings. In other words, you are, it's the first definitive arising of that movement towards wisdom and compassion, enlightenment for the benefit of all. So yes, when the bodhicitta arises, there is a shift, there is a change. So there's a dynamic quality to Shantideva's use of the term bodhicitta. So the term has been translated by Kate Crosby and Andrew Skilton as the awakening mind, the awakening mind, which suggests wisdom and compassion emerging and growing within the person that it's arisen in. Sangharakshita translates it as the will to enlightenment. He relates citta to the will, the will to enlightenment for the benefit of all beings. But he's careful to point out in that translation that he's not talking about egotistical will. It's not a personal will, not a sort of grasping will. It can't be, because the arising of the bodhicitta involves the dawning of seeing through the notion of fixed and separate selfhood. And in any case, the will, in the sense of the will to enlightenment, is really not personal at all. It's something more transpersonal. I think one of the reasons why Sangharakshita wants to emphasise the will here is to draw out the tremendous energy involved in the arising of the bodhicitta. It's the arising of a wise and compassionate energy and volition, which is manifesting in activity for the good of all, the liberation of all. So that's the bodhicitta. And the bodhicitta must have this tremendous energy. It does have this tremendous energy. Just look at that sixth verse where Shantideva speaks of the forces of evil being very terrible, and the implication is that the forces of evil can so easily overwhelm the good, can so easily overwhelm good acts, kind acts, positive acts, constructive acts. And Shantideva goes further and says that what is needed to threaten the forces of evil is the perfect bodhicitta, by which he means the fully developed mind of wisdom and compassion. So the bodhicitta needs, it has this tremendous energy that can push back the forces of darkness. Now, before going any further, I think we do need to look at this word evil. I know that some people feel rather uncomfortable about the word evil, and they even wonder why it's found in Buddhist texts at all, and even in our puja. They'll admit, of course, to having faults and failings, and they'll admit to seeing faults and failings in other people. But evil, isn't that a rather heavy word? Isn't that a bit heavy? The word in Sanskrit is papa. And actually, this word papa doesn't really have any other satisfactory translation. Papa means bad, evil, something harmful. You know, that you do to others and is done to you. What is interesting, though, in Buddhist tradition, evil doesn't have, it's not regarded as a kind of metaphysical principle. There's no evil force, as it were, running through the universe. The roots, as it were, of evil, like the roots of good, like the potential for enlightenment itself, reside in the human heart, in the human breast. The roots of evil are to be found in our own unskillful actions of body, speech and mind. The roots of evil are in our greed, in our craving, in our ill will, in our hatred, in our ignorance, in our delusion, confusion and all their variants. Pride, jealousy, envy, fear and so on. All these states and the actions proceeding from them are harmful to ourselves and to others. Now, probably we would all acknowledge that, but we would still feel uneasy about thinking of such states as evil. Aren't they just faults, bad habits? In a sense, no big deal. Why describe them as evil? But it's worth reflecting on what happens when those unskillful states get a grip on people, individually and collectively. What happens then? Especially if these states get caught up in survival, in just trying to stay alive when your life is threatened. Or especially if these unskillful roots that we have are manipulated by those in power. What happens then? I remember being very struck during the Balkan Wars, hearing, I think it was from our own correspondent, the Radio 4 programme, which is a really fantastic programme. It was about, there was a sort of divide between two communities, Serbian and Bosnian, I think. And these two old women were absolutely, they were shouting across this boundary. And they were shouting the most murderous insults to one another. Really nasty stuff. What was interesting was that they were old neighbours and old friends. There they were, now absolute enemies, hurling violent, hateful abuse at each other across a boundary and even delighting in each other's misfortune. What's interesting, yes, they were good and friendly neighbours while their country was secure. But as soon as anarchy broke out, they became deadly enemies and they fell back on their national identities. Now, that kind of violent response, I don't think you can just call that a fault. There's something so dark in it that perhaps evil is a better word. I had a more personal experience of this in India. I went to a very famous shrine in Bombay, and I was shown round by a very, very bright young Muslim lad, And he was telling me all about how wonderful this shrine was, the saint was, because of the blessing and protection that the shrine had given, the saint had given. And I said, well, you know, why was it? I mean, how did the saint help you? He said, well, I took refuge here during the Hindu-Muslim riots that were, you know, broke out in Bombay. They break out periodically, but it was the last set of terrible bloodletting that went on. And I said, oh, right, so, you know, you came here because you were, you know, you were to get away from all that. And he said, no, I came here because I killed a Hindu neighbour and the police were after me. And I said, well, how did you feel about, you know, killing a neighbour, you know, thinking, you know, he must feel terrible remorse. And he grinned and smiled. He said, I feel so happy, so proud that I've done my duty as a Muslim, killing that Hindu. And I felt, you know, me and my Buddhist friend who were there together, we were both completely stunned at this conversation. How would you describe that? It's not just the whole situation, the whole scene. It's not just a fault or bad habits. That's far too light. This is heavy stuff, terrible stuff. It's a terrible situation where terrible acts have gone on. Yes, evil acts, but in a sense, it's also extraordinarily ordinary. And there's a Hannah Arendt's famous book, isn't there? The Banality of Evil. You know, where she's considering the Eichmann trials, you know, and you know, all this sort of thing. You know, that evil is not actually that far away from us, so long as we have unskillful roots in our heart. That's the point I'm trying to make. The roots of evil are in our own everyday unskillfulness. Who knows what we would do if our life was threatened, if the life of loved ones was threatened. Are we absolutely certain that we would respond with wisdom, with kindness? Are we absolutely positive that we would act from our principles? Or would it be a matter of survival? And if it's the instinct to survive, there is no telling what will be unleashed by us. We live in a world in which terrible things happen. Terrible things emanating from those unskillful roots. Yes, good things are done as well. We know people do act from the good. I mean, just another story about the riots in Bombay, the Hindu-Muslim riots. Unfortunately, some Buddhists got caught up in that and wanted to join their Hindu neighbours in attacking a Muslim shop. And our order members and mitras stood in front of this shop and said, no, we do not do this. Buddhists do not live like this, and turned back the mob. So good things do happen, can happen. But so often the good does get trampled on or gets corrupted. So that's why Shanti Deva says that we need a stronger, deeper, purer kind of good, an indestructible good, an indestructible force for good. And that's the bodhicitta, the force, the mind of wisdom and compassion. I know that this kind of area arises for people who have worked in such spheres as social work or aid work or political engagement of some kind or another, or health work of various kinds and so on. I think you know the territory. The hands-on work of helping to alleviate the very obvious sufferings in the world around us. I've not actually done any of that myself. But I know people who have been involved in that work. And what they tell me, that it is so very hard. They work and work to make a difference, to bring about some change in the society, in the community, to make some progress. But so easily it's that the good is swept aside, swept away. Or there are just so many compromises and shifting conditions. And I know I've known people who just have ended up getting burnt out in trying to do this work, or just losing actually all faith and confidence in humanity. becoming rather jaded and cynical, even trying to make a difference. I know people like this. And there's no doubt about their feeling for others, no doubt about their wanting to make a real difference to the world around them. But those dark clouds, those dark forces of habit, of, yes, let's call it evil, seem to overwhelm again and yet again. What is needed, says Shantideva, is a deeper change, a lasting change in consciousness, in ourselves and in others. What is needed is the bodhicitta, the enlightened mind. If we want there to be lasting happiness in the world, it won't be enough to deal with the symptoms. We'll need to get down to transforming the deep roots that are the underlying cause of suffering in this world. We need to create in ourselves and in others what Shantideva says the Lord of the Sages, that's the Buddhas, have found through deep contemplation of the troubles of life. We need to find the deep welling happiness that overflows and uplifts immeasurable masses of beings. Shantideva believes that only the bodhicitta can do this. If you want yourself to transcend misery and sorrow in yourself, if you want all others to be truly free of sorrow, if you want there to be all-pervading joy, sooner or later you will have to start getting to grips with and transforming the depths of the minds of human beings. And that begins, of course, with ourselves. Yes, we can create good structures, good institutions, we can legislate and change the laws of the land to make things better. But for any lasting, indestructible good, you will have to change your mind and do all you can to help others change their minds. There really does need to be what we call in India a Dhamma revolution. And I saw this so vividly when I lived in India, studying the life and work of Dr. Ambedkar, the great Buddhist leader, the great Dalit leader who converted to Buddhism in 1956 and brought thousands and thousands of people with him into the Dharma. It's very, very, very important for me to see the effect of the Dharma on those people's lives. People who'd suffered from serious social inequality and oppression. And Dr. Ambedkar himself was an intensely practical and rational man. He brought that practicality and reason powerfully into play in his work to change Indian society, to free it from caste and untouchability and inequality. He worked in politics, in trades unionism, in education, in activism of all kinds. He worked in the law. He framed the Indian constitution. He was the first law minister of the government of independent India. But very early on, he recognised that if there was to be real and lasting change in society, you had to change deep attitudes. You might change the laws, but people's attitudes remain the same on a day-to-day basis. You had to change the depths of the mind, in other words, the selfish mind, the ignorant mind, the dualistic mind. There needed to be a deep spiritual change, and that's why he ended up converting to Buddhism. Because Buddhism recognised the centrality of the mind. And, you know, I saw the liberating effects of the Dharma on people. It didn't necessarily mean that there was, you know, huge changes in there in terms of sort of, increase of wealth and all that kind of thing. But the Dharma gave people a dignity and strength which they didn't have before. And seeing this, the effect of the Dharma on those people's lives, increased my own faith and confidence in the Dharma and how radical it is, what it can do to affect society generally. So if we're serious about really doing something for others, we will need to change our minds. We will need the wisdom aspect of the bodhicitta that will need to come into play. We could, of course, look at this from another point of view. Shantideva doesn't just speak of the bodhicitta alleviating the sufferings of others, of all others. He also says that those who wish to experience hundreds of joys, they too need to develop the bodhicitta. I think many of us are involved in the Dharma, involved in Buddhism, not because we necessarily wanted to alleviate the suffering of the world. We've perhaps come to the Dharma, we're involved in the Dharma, because we're searching ourselves for joy, for happiness, for meaning, for liberation from our difficulties. Well, if we want those things for ourselves, we too will need to develop the bodhicitta. We'll need especially to concentrate on its love and compassion aspect, because it's impossible really to enjoy the happiness of the Dharma without there being altruism. We need to think of also looking beyond ourselves and ensuring that our Buddhist practice is finding expression in benefiting and uplifting those around us, the people around us, the people we're actually immediately in contact with. We need to extend the range of people that we're involved with in our lives, the people that we actually touch, so that we can positively affect them through our practice, our Buddhist practice, our Buddhist life. I think one of the great dangers that Buddhists face is perhaps especially in modern times, and perhaps especially in the West, is that Buddhism just becomes another version of our self-centeredness, our selfishness. I think that's the sort of near enemy of the introspection that Buddhism can encourage. We can become over preoccupied with our mental states, which isn't the same thing as really investigating them in order to change them, but endlessly sifting through them, rather narcissistically, almost being fascinated by their mess, rather like looking at our own turds. We can become overly concerned with our own comforts. We can get very precious about such things as our diet. You know, we go through various health fads, the latest therapies, the latest techniques, the latest gadgets. But all too often these things can be so many versions of self-preoccupation. And we do much better to look around us and see what others actually need. The people right next to us see that there are people who are actually perishing because they don't have the Dharma, because they don't have access to what we have access to, perishing because they could be so much more. So we could be part of that whole process of bringing about the uplift of the world. And in doing so, we'll benefit ourselves. So Shantideva is very clear what kind of man is needed, what kind of man a bodhisattva is. Someone in whom the bodhicitta arises, he says of such a person these things. Immeasurable merit took hold of the well-intentioned person who thought, "Let me dispel the headaches of all beings." What then of the person who longs to remove the unequalled agony of every single being and for each one of them to make their virtue infinite? So Shantideva is asking us to imagine what it would be like to form the aspiration to find a cure for people's headaches permanently. You might have someone, a doctor, say, who really feels that the suffering of headaches really needs to be dispelled. And he has the genuine intention to cure the headache of every one of us for all time. Well, we can just possibly imagine that. But a bodhisattva, someone in whom the bodhicitta has arisen, is someone who wants to remove the suffering, every kind of suffering, physical suffering, psychological suffering, deep existential suffering, spiritual suffering, the suffering of not being enlightened. A bodhisattva wants to remove all of that for all time, for everybody. A bodhisattva really feels all that. He feels the suffering, in a sense, in all beings and wants to remove it. Not only that, he doesn't just want to remove suffering, he wants everybody to be filled with virtue. The word for virtue is guna, which means quality. He wants everybody to be rich in positive qualities, not just free of suffering, but rich in all the great and wonderful human and spiritual qualities. He wants everybody to flourish with positive qualities. So it's not just a question of removing suffering. Much more than that, he sees the potential in everybody, and he wants that potential to flourish and grow. He wants the abundance of everybody. And of course, that's how suffering is actually dispelled. He wants everybody to enjoy the bliss of fulfillment through the development of spiritual qualities. So this is what a bodhisattva is. This is what the arising of the bodhicitta means. It's the emergence of someone who has this deep aspiration to remove the black cloud of suffering that afflicts everybody, and for them all to be rich in virtues and qualities. Well, it's very hard to imagine such a person, such a being. Shantideva understands that, because he says, whose mother or father has such a desire for others' welfare as this? What deities or sages or holy men have it? Those beings did not conceive this desire before, even for their own sake, even in a dream. How could they have it for the sake of others? Such a being, the bodhisattva, unprecedented, an excellent jewel, in whom there is born a concern for the welfare of others, such as others have not even for themselves. How is he born? So Shantideva himself is really trying to fathom the nature of someone who is genuinely selfless, genuinely aware of the suffering of life, who isn't in any way sentimental about that. It's so easy to sort of almost enjoy, get off on, so much about the suffering of life, without really doing anything about it. Shantideva, though, sees this suffering very clearly, and he wants to do all he can to alleviate that suffering by giving people the Dharma so that they might develop the qualities necessary for liberation, for enlightenment. It's very, very hard to imagine. It's easy to be sentimental about this, or to find it such an utterly overwhelming ideal, and it should feel overwhelming, that we just think, well, let's just not bother. Let's just, go home and, get on the sofa and watch Christmas television. I'm glad you don't want to do that. But Shantideva is clear throughout his text that we can always move in the direction of the bodhicitta. We have an affinity with it. We saw that yesterday. We have something in us that really does respond. Sangharakshita calls this the bodhisattva principle, and he says the bodhisattva principle manifests wherever a kind and intelligent act is performed. I think that's really important to stay in touch with. We do possess kindness. We do possess intelligence. We do possess friendliness. We do possess awareness. Whenever we act from that, there is the bodhisattva principle. There is the seed of the bodhicitta. So we have that affinity. We have that potential. And if we dwell on it, it will completely transform us. And it's very clear to Shantideva that the arising of the bodhicitta involves a total transformation. Not just a little change, not just a bit of tinkering, but a total and complete transformation, even a spiritual rebirth. And Shantideva describes this transformation using the metaphor of Indian alchemy, Rasayana, as it's called, particularly in its aspect of transmuting base metal into pure gold. I particularly love this verse for some reason. I don't quite know why, but I think it really has made a big impression on me over the years. Taking this base image of the human form, the Bodhisattva transmutes it into the priceless image of the Buddha jewel. Grasp tightly this highly potent quicksilver elixir known as the bodhicitta, which must be thoroughly worked. So the base image is our unenlightened state, our ordinary human state, whatever it is. That's our raw material. Whatever we are, however we are, whatever state we're in, that's always our starting point. That's where the process of transformation and transmutation begins. And we need to work that highly potent quicksilver elixir of the bodhicitta into whatever we are to bring about the transformation into the image of the Buddha jewel, the Suvanamani, the golden jewel. In alchemy, of course, there are various stages of transformation. And in the same way, there are stages and steps in our own transformation. And one description of these stages is found in one of our most familiar practices, something we practice regularly. That is the sevenfold puja. I did look up some alchemical material recently, and according to some traditions, there are seven steps in the alchemical process, but I don't know if they relate to our puja. I haven't gone into that. Maybe people into alchemy can follow all that up. But traditionally, the sevenfold puja is regarded as one of the main practices that leads to the arising of the bodhicitta. And of course, the sevenfold puja comes from the Bodhicharyavatara. We are reciting Shantideva's words. We're doing his puja when we do the puja. And it's important to remember that the sevenfold puja isn't just a ceremony, a ritual. We recite the words to connect with, to develop a particular mood, a particular attitude, a particular emotion. These moods, attitudes, emotions coming together so that the base image, I've lost my page. So these moods, these attitudes, these emotions come together. And when we fully live them through, they bring about a transformation. This base form, this unenlightened state begins to be transfigured, transmuted into the bodhisattva. In a way, we've got that symbolism in the puja because after the seven stages, we chant the mantras of the different Buddhas and bodhisattvas. And it's you can regard the mantras of the different Buddhas and Bodhisattvas as sort of crystallizations of the bodhicitta itself. We do the seven stages in order to then open up to contemplate the bodhicitta itself. That's what we're trying to do. So let's look at each stage of the puja. First of all, there's worship, puja itself. And as you know, here we make offerings of flowers and incense, lights and perfumes and food and drink. We imagine these when we recite the words that we're making these offerings. And in the full text of the Bodhicharyavatara itself, the offerings are extraordinarily lavish. And I think tonight we'll have a longer worship section so we can begin to appreciate Shantideva's puja a lot more. And Shantideva really goes a long way with this worship. In the text itself, there's a certain point where he describes washing and cleaning and clothing the images of the Buddha. He offers everything, all of the most wonderful, pleasing and beautiful things throughout the entire world. It's as if Shantideva is saying if he actually owned the entire world, he would offer it. He would offer it to the Buddha, to all the Buddhas, to the Dharma, to the Bodhisattvas. And these verses are extremely beautiful in the Bodhicharyavatara. It's just like a hymn of praise, you know, and offering. Really very, very lovely. Real expression of love and devotion. So what's the significance of this? Shantideva is adoring, worshipping his highest spiritual ideals, which is of course, which are of course expressions of the bodhicitta. The bodhicitta for Shantideva is not some abstract principle, philosophical principle. He worships, he adores the bodhicitta embodied in the most beautiful of forms, beautiful and meaningful to him. And this is of very, very great importance. Shantideva has described the bodhicitta as the highly potent quicksilver elixir that has the power to transform our basic self-centered human nature. But how can that bodhicitta reach into us? How can it touch our deepest desires and volitions? Ideas, abstractions, moral exhortations, even meditations are not really enough. What will really touch us in the end is beauty. A beautiful, fascinating, deeply meaningful form, colour and shape and image that can really touch us, that can really transfix us, if you like. So one of the things we're going to need to do, if we're going to find this highly potent quicksilver elixir to transform us, is to find an image, a form, a symbol, a myth expressive of the bodhicitta. It's not illustrating the bodhicitta, but which in a sense is the bodhicitta, as something tangible that we can really let into the depths. Something that really carries and bears the bodhicitta. Yes, an image, a form that symbolises the state of supreme wisdom and compassion. It's why we have these images. Why eventually this room will be completely filled with different beautiful images. These are all gateways, if you like, different ways in which we can connect with the bodhicitta. We have, of course, to discover that for ourselves. We have to find what speaks to us, which means, first of all, noticing the images, the myths, the stories that actually move us, perhaps have moved us since childhood. Muhammad says, "I have seen my Lord in the most beautiful forms." This is a saying, a hadith, which the Sufis, the great Sufi mystics regularly meditate on. I have seen my Lord in the most beautiful forms. The abstract, transcendent, always comes as a specific, beautiful form that draws us out beyond ourselves, draws us into something that's actually beyond, in the end, all representation. I said that yesterday that Shantideva's personal spiritual friend, his Kalyanamitra, was Manjushri, Manjugosha. So that we could say that for Shantideva, the bodhicitta shone out for him as that beautiful form, Manjugosha. He had an affinity with that particular form and shape and myth and colour and symbolism. That's the way the bodhicitta communicated with him. It was like with like, another very important alchemical hermetic principle. There's something in us that has a resonance with the bodhicitta, but it will come in a particular way to us. So in a sense, before we can even offer worship, we need to discover the form to worship, to adore, the form to which our deepest and strongest emotions can flow. We need to find what we can fully and totally love. That could, of course, be the Buddha himself. All forms, the different Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, are in a sense expressions of the Buddha. So we need to find that image that we can really surrender to. Then it will really touch our deepest forces. We need to find that highly potent quicksilver elixir. So the second stage of the puja is vandana, salutation, or obeisance. So this stage naturally opens through contemplating the beautiful forms expressive of the bodhicitta, we see that they are vastly greater than ourselves. The bodhicitta is sublime, is majestic. Shantideva sees it in one place, describes it as a great sun, dispelling the darkness of ignorance. And we are just awe-inspired by it. So we bow down, we salute, we prostrate in deep reverence. We serenely accept the majesty of the enlightened mind. We feel, in a sense, small in relation to that vast mind, that vast consciousness. Not diminished by it, but we have an appropriate sense of proportion. This state of reverence, of revering, of looking up to what is greater than us is of very, very great importance. It's one of the signs that our pride, our conceit, our self-cherishing is beginning to sort of diminish, beginning to dissolve. And of course, we do live in an age where people don't really revere at all, or revere very rarely. We find it often very difficult to acknowledge someone or something greater than ourselves, which means spiritual transformation is actually very difficult. In this stage, we meditate deeply on the sublimity of the bodhicitta. It's very interesting when you look at descriptions of visionary experience in whatever tradition. When the vision arises, the person undergoing the vision is just filled with wonder and awe. Sometimes they describe their hair standing on end at this extraordinary image. The third stage is called going for refuge, Sharanagamana. So when you have a real sense of spiritual proportion, when you encounter that profound, sublime, awe-inspiring bodhicitta, you feel, and you see it manifesting particularly, that mind of enlightenment in the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha, you come to feel that these are completely reliable spiritual ideals. They won't let you down. They're too big to let you down. At last you've found something big enough, deep enough, not to let you down. There's something that is completely dependable, that you can move towards, that you want to move towards. It's very interesting, in Indian alchemical traditions, there's great concern to attain an indestructible body, an iron-hard body or a vajra body, great concern to attain the deathless, the immortal. And this is taken quite literally, apparently. Buddhist tradition would say that's not possible. It's not possible to live forever, because everything, after all, is impermanent. Everything arises and passes away. The Buddha himself wouldn't want to, in a sense, live forever physically. But the Buddha did indeed describe the enlightened state, the enlightened mind, as the deathless, the amrita, which means the nectar of the deathless, the nectar of immortality. And perhaps the best way to think of this is that the enlightened mind, the enlightened state, the bodhicitta, is perpetually and inexhaustibly creative. The man of wisdom and compassion is always creative in response to what life throws up, including illness, loss, death itself. You see this if you read the life of the Buddha, the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, the Buddha's response to his terrible illness and pain and the prospect of death. You see this endlessly creative response, and the creative response to his disciples. So we can think of the deathless as being endlessly creative in relation to others. So the enlightened state, the Buddha, is indeed a refuge in this sense. Shantideva says, all ordinary goodness, having shed its fruit, like the banana tree, begins to decay. But the tree of the bodhicitta begets and does not decay. It bears fruit perpetually. So we go for refuge. We make a full commitment to attaining the bodhicitta. In the fourth stage, we confess our faults. This is called papadeshana, confession of evil. And in this stage, what's happened is our very act of commitment to the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha, to the Bodhicitta, reveals to us all the things that are impeding us in our movement towards the Bodhicitta. All the things in us that are the exact opposite of the Bodhicitta. Taking a step, a decisive step in the direction of wisdom and compassion, reveals to us our ignorance, our confusion, our unknowing, our doubts, our willful stupidity, our meanness, selfishness, ill will, our general negativity. The term that confession translates is deshana, which means literally a pointing out. We see very, very clearly and honestly all that is not congruent with the bodhicitta. We really own it, own up to it, and we reveal it, we confess it in relation to our ideals, even if necessary, in relation to our spiritual friends. And when we really do this, this itself, confession itself, can be a profound spiritual experience. Sangharakshita has described it as a sort of vomiting up and expelling of all the deep negative roots in our consciousness. Real confession is a purging, like the physical body being purged of poisons and toxins. And of course, in doing that, we feel light and purified and carefree. We're purifying the base metal of all its admixtures. And of course, we begin to act differently after such a genuine confession. We're more in harmony with the bodhicitta, with wisdom and compassion. So then naturally, the fifth stage arises. This is rejoicing in merit, or rejoicing in the good, punyana modana. We rejoice in all that is good, all the good acts done by anybody, anywhere, done by everybody, everywhere, perhaps. We rejoice in the qualities, the glorious qualities of the Buddha, of the Bodhisattvas. And the mood here is one of real rejoicing, even of celebration. We're just delighting in the good all around. And in life, in our life generally, we're always relating to the good in others. Even if everybody else is only seeing the dark side, even if it is actually all dark, we always look to the good and give voice to the good and voice to our delighting in the good in others. And thus we strengthen the good in the world. We can, as William Blake says, start building a heaven in hell's despair. So we open to the good in everybody. So there's a tremendous positivity and joyous quality in this stage, and a real openness in this stage of the puja. So naturally, this leads to entreaty and supplication, adyesana yachana. Here we are fully and completely open to the influence of the bodhicitta. It's not a passivity or anything like that, but we're alert and receptive. We want to really hear, we want to really listen to the teaching of the Buddha. We want it to go deeply into the depths of the heart. We're actually here prepared to do anything to develop ourselves, to benefit others. We're prepared for any direction that the teacher, that the spiritual friend, that the Buddha gives us. We want to wait and listen and learn. And often within our pujas at this point, we have a reading from the scriptures and the Heart Sutra. So the whole idea here is that we're really open to the teaching. We're really open to the word of the Buddha or a great Bodhisattva. We really listen to that voice so that it can actually transform us. We're open to that wisdom. And there's a real urgency in the entreaty and supplication. Sometimes people complain that if only they had better teachers, if only, you know, you were a better teacher, you were a better spiritual friend, it was a better order, a better spiritual community, and so on, then they would really progress. Then they would really do it. But the real issue very often is that people aren't hungry enough. We're not thirsty enough for the Dharma. The teaching is there. It really is there. But we don't really take it in. We don't really eat it and drink it. We don't really engage with it with any real energy and interest. But here in Treaty and Supplication, we really want to learn the Dharma. We really want to apply the Dharma. We really do want to become a servant of the Dharma, a servant of the Bodhicitta, a servant actually to all beings. So this leads us to the final stage, transference of merit and self-surrender. Merit, which I don't think is a very good translation of the word punya. It can also mean good. It's this idea that you're positive, you're creative, your skillful action results in happiness and well-being and good things for you. Punya, though, you can think of as really your positive momentum in life. But you want to share that. That's the whole point in this last stage. You want all the good things that have happened to you to spread around for the greater good so that everyone may be well. So transferring our merit means giving up, giving away whatever good things that we have, our talents, our abilities, our goodness, our energy, even our material, the good material things we have. We give it away. In fact, we give ourselves away. We surrender ourselves. Shantideva has that beautiful aspiration of wanting to become like the elements, like earth and water and fire and air, that support and maintain, that actually give life to all beings. So we aspire to be that ourselves. And it's very important here, there's no sense of loss in this stage, no sense of privation. The bodhisattva is abundant. The bodhicitta gives abundance. You're rich with the Dharma, rich with bodhicitta, rich with inspiration. You see your own life as part of something much, much, much bigger. You're positively surrendering yourself to the stream of wisdom and compassion, to the bodhicitta, which you don't regard as anything, in a sense, personal, certainly not a personal attainment, as the Heart Sutra says, attainment to its emptiness. So those notions of attainment for yourself have really vanished in this stage. This is why Bhante Sangharakshita sees the bodhicitta, the force of wisdom and compassion, as something that really inspires a community, a spiritual community. It's something that animates a spiritual community, a spiritual community working together throughout the vast reaches of time and space to enable all beings to enjoy the happiness of enlightenment. So we need to think of the bodhisattva not just as one person. That's sort of impossible. Really, the bodhisattva is a sort of transpersonal stream of consciousness that we all link up to, if you like. So in this last stage of the puja, there should be a feeling of real celebration, of giving up for the benefit of all. So this is the transformation that can happen through practicing and living the sevenfold puja. Actually, our whole life we can think of as a puja. That might perhaps be something to think about. How can our whole life be a sevenfold puja? How can we practice all these stages day to day? This is what we need to be doing. Shantideva really celebrates the arising of the bodhicitta in his texts. He sees its arising, he sees his life, he sees the bodhicitta as a great feast, a great banquet. It's a lovely image which he's sort of presiding over, which he wants everybody who are, you know, weary and hungry and starving and famished and so on. He wants everybody to attend, to participate in this wonderful feast. You know, we're traditionally in a time of feasting, and I can tell you, feasting in India is a very, very important thing. You know, the big meal is a very important event in India, and of course it's a communal activity. So we should think of when we're doing the last stage of the puja, or all of our practice, of inviting people to a great feast. So we'll finish with Shantideva's words. For the caravan of humanity, blundering along the road of existence, hungering for the enjoyment of happiness, this is a feast of happiness, forever prepared for the complete refreshment of all beings who come near. Now I invite the world to Buddhahood and to all kinds of happiness. In the presence of the Buddhas, may gods, titans, and all rejoice.